Interview with Robert Birnbaum, April 30th, 2007, in Boca Raton, Florida, by Kenneth Durr.
Okay, so...
All right, so you were working days and you went to Georgetown Law at night.
Right,
in D.C.
Right, yeah.
How did you, how were you approached to join the SEC?
Well, my best friend was, we had lived together in New York, actually. He got his first legal job at the SEC. And when I came back from California, I started Georgetown, and I went to work for the General Accounting Office. And he got me, they had this special study which Congress had authorized money for, and he got me an interview there, and there I was hired. So that was my big break, actually.
I mean, yeah.
You know, really, I could have been God knows what. You know,
tucked away in the GAO.
Oh, GAO was terrible. It was really terrible because I hadn't been in school for about 10 years. And I was never a student to begin with. I mean, school was like a joke for me. I spent the whole time in the study hall looking at the girls. I never went to class.
Yeah.
When I was on the board of New York, president of NYU was on the board, congressman from Indiana, well-known guy, I can't think of his name. And he was on the board with me, and we were going off the board. And so they always have a dinner for the incoming and outgoing. The dinner was held at NYU in their beautiful Bops Library, which the guy had done a gorgeous place. Wasn't there when I was there. And so when I got up to speak, I said, you all know that I'm a graduate of NYU, and I have to tell you, this is the first time I've ever been in the library. I said, I didn't know where the library was, you know, but it was true. I mean, I always thought, how did I get through college? I mean, I used to wait till a week before the finals,
yeah,
and then study.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I just, you know, hung around with the basketball team. I mean, it was a joke.
Well, that clearly wasn't the case here when you came into the SEC.
Well, I love the SEC because at the GAO, I was working in some legislative digesting, I don't know what it was. And when I'd walk around, I would literally see lawyers sleeping in their offices. And then I came to the SEC, and the guys were screaming and yelling and okay, cursing, and it was action, it was wild. I mean, I had all these young, extremely bright guys, you know, and so it was great for me to get into this kind of an atmosphere. I felt terrific. I loved it there. I really did.
So everybody had a specialty in the special study. What area were you?
Yeah, on? Well, you can't say a specialty because I didn't know anything about anything. You were assigned to work on certain things.
Okay.
I worked on one of the sections I worked on was margin. I worked a lot. I went over to the Federal Reserve people to work there. The credit thing, we made changes. And then I worked on the bringing the... It's amazing what you don't remember. Bringing the proxy insider trading rules. In those days, I think it was Section 14, 15, and 16 of the Act. They were only on exchange-listed companies.
Mm-hmm.
That I worked on bringing those regulatory requirements to companies of size in the over-the-counter market.
Uh-huh.
You know? I mean, we figured out I was setting what standard we should use, how many shareholders, how much money. We did a survey of companies and, I learned how to work with the IBM punch cards then, putting it in a machine. It was, you know, so it was terrific. And the leadership there to study was very unusual, guys. I mean, they really were. I mean, the director was a guy, Milton Cohn, who was a well-known lawyer from Chicago. He died several years ago. And he was a slave driver, but he's terrific. And then Ralph Saul was second, and Ralph was a wonderful, intelligent man. And then the other three guys that were on the top five guys was a guy, Dick Paul from Paul Weiss Rifkin. He also died very young, and he was a very, very bright guy. I mean, I've been sitting with him, and he would dictate a complaint without looking at a thing, just dictate the whole thing for about 45 minutes, and unbelievable. And that's after he had four martinis for lunch, because he liked the booze. And then a man who was a friend of mine from then on, it was really, he was very instrumental in me doing well. He was the chief economist, and he came down, he was a professor at Columbia Graduate School, Sid Robbins. And he came down and worked Monday and Tuesday, like he'd work till like 1 a.m. on Monday and 12 o'clock on Tuesday, and then he'd go back to New York. And I somehow got involved working with him a lot. And he would say to everybody, hey, this is one of the brightest guys you've got here. Nobody knew who the heck I was. And so I remained friends all my life with him. After he left and went back to Columbia, I used to go teach one of his classes every year. And we remained friends. He's still alive. He's about 94, Sid, and he's in not a nursing home. He's not even assisted living, like an adult community in Stanford. I mean, but he's mentally still not bad.
And he was an economist.
He was an economist, but he was one of the few economists who got rid of all the baloney. He always had something, how you could take action about something. You know, he didn't just theorize. Mm-hmm. He was terrific. And the fifth guy was a guy, Herb Schick, who I'm sure is dead, who was a bright lawyer from Philadelphia. I don't think he ended up doing well, though. Because when I was president of New York, he had been with a major firm in Philadelphia. And I had done a lot of work with him. And he wrote to me looking for a job in New York, not even a big job. He something didn't do well there, you know. But I think they were lucky, the SEC in those days. The SEC in those days certainly was considered, if you were a lawyer, the government was the only place to work, unless you had a special interest about something, you know. The two places to work were the Justice Department and the SEC. And the SEC had all these bright young guys, a large percentage of them Jewish, because they couldn't get hired by Wall Street firms in those days.
Right.
See, today it's different. I mean, today they, you know. So it was phenomenal. I mean, you know, Poser was from Harvard. Dave Silver was from Harvard. I mean, there's a guy, Art Rothkopf, I think, was from Harvard. He became president of one of the universities. I forget where he is today. I don't know. So it was a very unusual group. And it was a very close-knit group because we didn't have a big staff. I mean, professionally, maybe if you added everybody up, including the secretaries, maybe we had 60 people,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we covered an unbelievable amount of ground. I mean... it's still quoted today, some, you know, the special
right.
study, which is very unusual.
Right.
So it was a great experience for me, and that's how I ended up getting hired at the exchange, and
sure.
that's, you know, people knew me, and I could have been, God knows, like, you know, I would have been happy to stay at the SEC all my life, except I didn't have any money. You know, so,
yeah.
you know, so you almost had a, you know, maybe you can make a living there, but you know, when I left the SEC, I was a branch chief, and I think I was making. I was married with a kid already, and I think another one on the way. I don't know if the other one was on the way yet, I think I was making $14,000, and I had done very well. They gave me, you know, what they used to do. They used to give me when I first started. I think I was making like $5,000 a year. You were making, you know.
Yeah.
They used to give me, and you couldn't get a raise. They had a Witten lawyer. Certainly, you had to wait a year to get a grade raise.
Mm-hmm.
They used to give me $20 in expenses a week. I mean, which was just to give me the money.
Yeah.
So I got an extra $1,000. It was a lot of money in those days. You're making $5,000 to get an extra $1,000. You know.
Yeah.
So. It was a great place, and I was lucky in my career because when I went to the American Stock Exchange, the same man, Ralph Saul, who had hired me to come to the government, had left and went to work for Investors Diversified Services in the big mutual. And then a year later, he became president of the exchange. So I went with him, and and Imposa came there, and there were other guys. Fred Cecil, I think, was there. Working there, people asked me, what's the difference? It was very much the same as working in the government. I was working at first with Ralph Saul, and he used to say to me, Bob, why don't you, first I was his assistant, I think. He would say, why don't you find out what the floor traders are doing on the exchange? What the hell are they doing? Or the guys off the floor who were trading, members who were sitting in Short Hills, New Jersey, and trading, what are they doing? And I would disappear for 3 weeks,
And this is when you're at Amex?
Yeah, yes, when I was at Amex. And I would disappear for 3 weeks and go interview guys in Connecticut and Greenwich, Connecticut, in huge mansions, and watch them trade and whatever. And then I would write them a report. And then I would say, we should do this. That's the kind of assignments I had. And I did. Talking about the exchange, is that all right, or you want to concentrate on it?
Yeah, no,
and I, I never thought I would be at the exchange more than a year or two, because there was no job that I would take there. I mean, I didn't want to stay at the exchange. And, the only job I would have thought of would be to be the general counsel. And I didn't have a shot at that when I started. And then they offered me, I went a couple of different things, and then they offered me to be an officer and take over one of the divisions. And I turned them down. And I said, no, I don't want to do that.
Why not?
Well, I thought I'd be into the bureaucratic thing at the exchange. I didn't want to sit off. Here I was working for the assistant to the chairman. I was in on all the action, and I really didn't want to take it. The first time I took it, I'm sure I could have got fired many times. They probably considered firing me, I'm sure, because things got very bad in 73, 74. It was no business. The place was terrible. I think we were doing New York was doing about 10 million shares a day. We were doing about 1 million shares a day. I didn't let the guys eat lunch until I checked the tape to see how much, I would go out and look at the tape. And I had been there I came there in 67, and 70 by 73, I still hadn't, nobody ever worked for me. And I only reported to one guy. And so finally, the first time I took a line job was when they made me executive vice president.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So you were doing special projects.
A lot of special projects, yeah.
Well, let's go back a little bit to your special project for the SEC.
Yeah.
And you talked about you were doing margins, you were looking at insider trading.
Yeah, well, when I first started there, I found out what it's like to be a lawyer, a good lawyer. The first assignment I had, one of the things, few things I remember, first assignment is they asked me to do a history of the regional stock exchanges. So I disappeared and worked on that, And then Milton Cohn said to me, well, you can finish. I said, I'm almost finished, and I brought it into him. And it was like, it was a huge thing like this. And he took it from me, Milton, and he went, very good job. He waited. I'm sure it was garbage. I'm sure it was total garbage. He just went like this, very good job. No, but I did, but a lot of stuff, the over-the-counter thing I spent a lot of time on, that was a big project. Because we were working, getting ready to recommend legislation, because you needed to have congressional legislation to put those things into effect.
My understanding was the special study was really more prescriptive or more diagnostic, more here's how things work, rather than saying this is the kind of law you need to fix it.
Well, True and not true. It was diagnostic, absolutely, because we started out knowing nothing. You know, we didn't know. What did we know about the securities business? Most of us didn't know anything. You know, what did we know about Wall Street? Most of us knew nothing. And so, yes, but we made, I don't remember the figures today, but we made probably 100 recommendations. And each, at the end of each chapter, I have it here if you want to look at it. At the end of each chapter, there were significant recommendations.
Okay.
So we made a lot of recommendations.
Your chapter? Was that on the over-the-counter?
Over-the-counter was a big part of what I worked on, yes, yes.
I mean, did you have a chapter or were you working with other folks?
I was working with other people, I think. Not a lot of people. There was never... You know, like on the credit thing, I think it was only one guy I was working on. I think Jim Bacon. I don't know if you ever heard Jim's name.
Tell me about that regional exchange work. I would think that would be interesting, seeing as where your career went later on.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with my career later on. But, yeah, you know, it was good for me. I found out a lot about what, you know, what went on.
Did you actually go visit regional exchange?
No. Funny. Yes, you know, you can't imagine what it was like. When the study was over, one of the recommendations was that the SEC should have periodic examinations of all the exchanges. You know, pick an area, whether it's enforcement or whatever. You know, and whether it's the specialist or the floor trade, and send two or three guys up to New York for a couple of days and let them, and then they come back, write a report, and we would then say to the exchange what they're doing right or wrong. Well, I remember this to this day. They sent David Silver and myself up to New York, and we were just a young, Dave was smart, but I was a young idiot. And we went up to New York, and we met with the president of the Amex, was a guy, Ted Etherington. That's really how I got to the Amex, even before Ralph Saul asked me to go with him. Ted Etherington was the president, and he asked me to come work for him. But before I could accept, I hadn't accepted yet, he accepted a job as president of Wesleyan University. So I never went there. Then Ralph came to me right after that. But we went up to New York, and we met. And when we met, I remember when we met with Ted Etherington, he had all of these senior officers at lunch with us. And when we told them what we were going to do, they couldn't believe it, that these guys from Washington are going to come to the exchange. They didn't know any. The guys at the SEC had never been to the exchanges. They had never been to the New York Stock Exchange. You can't imagine. They had one guy at the SEC, one, who was in charge of regulation of the over-the-counter market. One person. They didn't know anything. And you know, they couldn't believe that we were coming. They used to treat you, you know, when we first started going to New York, the president was a guy, Keith Funston, and they had hired him from the president of the university. He was just a good-looking marketing guy, didn't know anything. He was a nice man, didn't know anything.
Yeah.
He used to go around the country. They told him to go around the country, make speeches, own a share of America. I mean, that was his theme. The guy who ran the place was a guy, Ed Gray, his executive VP. When we used to go up there, they used to put us on the top floor of the exchange. You had to take the elevator up, get off, take another elevator, three floors. I don't think there were any phones there. They treated us like we were garbage. I mean, it was unbelievable. We called it the Gray Method, you know. You know, but the whole thing was so different. And Wall Street didn't know about the SEC, really. Today, you know, the SEC is, they know about it. In those days, the major firms said, SEC, what are you talking about? I remember when we sent Gene Rotberg and Fred Morse up to Morgan Stanley when we started. We were going to have very detailed questionnaires to some of the major firms. So we sent Fred Morris and Gene Rotberg up to Morgan Stanley to tell them, this is going to be what we're doing. They couldn't even get an appointment at Morgan Stanley. The only way they got the appointment, Bonnie Woodside, who was a commissioner, well-known guy, been there for years, great guy, Bonnie Woodside had to call Morgan Stanley to get these two young lawyers an appointment. And when they went up there, I mean, the story I don't even want to repeat, but have you ever heard the story?
I have.
So there's probably a lot of lies in the story by today.
Yeah.
Fred Morris was my best friend, so I mean. You know,
well, I think I'm going to let Gene Rotberg.
No, Gene has always been a liar, though. Gene could always exaggerate. I mean.
Well, so the idea, I guess, was that the industry wasn't really worried about the SEC.
Oh, not at all. No, not at all. You know, but then when the special, you know, when the special study came out with its report in 1963, after 2 years. The headlines in the New York Times were this high. And it was, I have the clips, they gave us the clips as one of our presents of the papers all over the United States. It was huge. But till then, nothing, they didn't know anything about. The SEC was, no. Well, you know, I think it had come off a Republican administrations. And I think the philosophy of most of the Republican administrations was, let the industry alone. I mean, don't bother with them. They were not regulatory minded, I don't think.
Right.
And maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong.
Now, you know, the special study, I get the sense, was this almost its own group within the SEC.
It was in its own group, right, absolutely. But, you know, but when I was working there, I was working for the SEC, even though I was in the own group. And you got to know a lot of people at the commission who weren't on the special study. One guy in particular, I remember, Art Fleischer, who was the executive assistant to Bill Carey, the chairman. We were friends, and he was our liaison really to the chairman. And yeah, you got to know a lot of people, and it was funny, you know, funny little things I remember. In those days, the SEC building was what we called the tar paper shack, which had been built as a temporary place. I mean, we worked. I had an office with a guy, Gary Strom, a lovely guy who's now dead. We had an office like 4x5. We sat with our desks facing one another. The place was piled high with stuff. We had no windows in the office. You know how hot Washington, no air conditioning. We were young, though. Who cares? I never thought about it. But you used to go to lunch, and they had a cafeteria. Everybody used to go to lunch in the same place. And you'd sit down and say, Ken, where do you work? You say, well, I'm in Corp Fin. And then you talk about when we moved to the new building and we didn't have a cafeteria. Everybody used to go out to eat. You never saw anybody except the people who were on your floor. The other divisions never had any interaction. It was funny, just that little thing of socializing and meeting people. You found out what people were doing, and it was great. And that disappeared once they got a nice building.
Yeah.
It was funny. Funny kind of things, yeah.
I guess one of the things I was getting at was, this is the early 60s, Kennedy administration, in New Frontier.
Yeah, I remember when Kennedy was shot. I came back to the office, and we had to figure out what we should do. I remember coming back to see Ralph Saul. And we wanted to stop trading, although we didn't even know if we had the authority. I don't know, you know, we were running around like crazy there. But
was there a sense of idealism throughout the whole?
Oh yeah, but you have to remember Washington in those days. Kennedy first came in; it was this glamorous place to be. You know, Washington was the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. You know, so yes, there was a sense. You know. But I always used to say, people used to say, well, what are you working for? Guys would come up with grandiose things. I'm trying to protect public investors. I said, let me tell you something. The only reason I'm working is I got a lovely wife and children, and that's why I'm working. I said, I'm trying to take care of my family, you know. You know, yeah, it's great to be, I mean, I never thought that I would do you know, when I came to the exchange, I knew I would never do anything dishonest. That I was trying to do the same thing. I mean, I was trying to do the same thing. I mean, trying to run a marketplace which was had integrity. Everything was done on the up and up. Same, to me, it was the exact same thing. I really never felt any different when I was at the exchange. That's what I was trying to do.
It's not like being on one side.
No, it wasn't to me. It was not at all like being on, you know, because I was always had guys who had worked in Washington with me. There was a lot of that. Yeah, to me, there was not two sides, you know. I worked for, I always had chairmen who were very decent guys with integrity, so that's a big thing, you know. Like Ralph Saul, you worked for Ralph Saul. I mean, I'm sure Ralph Saul has never done anything that he could even say maybe he was on the borderline of doing something unethical. Once in a while, I might have, yes. But he never did, I'm sure, you know. So it was the same to me. Yeah, you do things like, you know, when I first got to the American Exchange, the commission rates, in those days they had fixed commission rates, and they were under attack. And I had been part of the attack on the other side. And then when we came to the exchange, Ralph and I, we went down and testified, and, you know, we worked, I remember, we must have worked 3 weeks. We didn't go home. We ate breakfast, lunch, dinner at the exchange. Didn't even go home. We were preparing to testify, and we defended it, of course. And I said, look, anybody who gives up a monopoly has to be an idiot. You don't give up a monopoly if you're in business until you have to, you know. Of course, we defended it. And I mean, yes, I knew that probably it was better to not have fixed rates for everybody, but it wasn't better for us.
Right.
You know, so I'm working for them. If you don't like who you're working for, you ought to get another place to go.
Yeah.
You know?
Take me back a little bit. You mentioned, and this issue of fixed commission rates is, you know, looms really large here in the late 60s.
Right,
70s.
Right.
And you said that you had been part of the attack when you were at the
SEC. Yeah, well, we knew that.
What your role was?
I didn't have a major role in it, but we knew, we used to talk about it, we knew that the fixed rates, the business had changed over a number of years from 100 share investors to a tremendous amount of institutional investing. Now mutual funds were getting big, and they were trading 10,000 share lots. Well, you didn't have to be a genius to realize that timesing 100 shares by 100 for 10,000 doesn't make any sense, you know, because to execute the order is the exact same thing. You walked out to the post and you executed 100 shares. You walked out to the post and said, I got a block, and you executed that, and you get in the commissions. And then, of course, they had what they called give-ups in those days. You would execute the order, and you would get $100, and the guy who gave you the order would say, I want you to give $20 to my aunt in Kalamazoo, $10, and they would distribute the money around. Give-ups. So, I mean, it didn't take much to realize you shouldn't have been paying these guys were getting paid too much in order, if they were willing. Look, I remember to this day when the hearings, I had gone to the exchange and they held hearings on the commission rates. And Gene Rotberg was he was a great questioner. He could get you, he could lead you into a trap so beautifully, you know. And I remember he had a guy testifying, and I was down there. The exchange sent me to observe, you know. And he was questioning a guy who was a very nice character, you know, a Damon Runyon character, who had four seats on the Amex, I think. And he was talking to this guy, and he said to the guy, when he got to the give-ups, you know, well, why did you do that? The guy said, how rich did I want to be? I mean, you knew that, you know. I remember when it was over, Gene was patting himself on the back, and I said to Gene, you know, Gene, the first thing you should figure out is what you want to have after this is over. Just to destroy something without knowing where you're going is stupid to me. Yes, you destroyed them, but now what are we going to do? You know,
Wasn't the assumption that the rates would be competitive after that?
Well, it went slowly. You didn't go right to that. I mean, first, you know, because if the exchanges had been smart, they never would have gotten to that. If the exchanges had been smart, and they weren't, they would have immediately offered volume discounts. You know, they would have protected what they had by offering discounts, so the rates, when you started to get higher, instead of letting it go completely negotiated, they would have, you know, they're probably better off today. Look at the, who can figure out what the business is today? I mean, you know, who, I mean, I talked, I'm still a little bit involved because I'm on the board of, right now I'm on the board of the Chicago Board Options Exchange. So I get a lot of, you know, the CEO was a guy who was my executive VP at the Amex, so I get a lot of, you know, he calls me every week, they ask me what he should do about something. And the volume is beyond anybody's imagination. You know, I mean, nobody could have dreamed of it. Where it's all coming from, you get a different story from every professional, you know. And the option business is bigger than the equity business. I remember the first day options reported to me when it started at the Amex in 1975. And I think the first day we did 13 contracts. I mean, I remember first, I mean, and who could have dreamed it would, you know, when the Chicago people came to New York to talk about options, they went to the Amex in New York and the Chicago Board of Trade started it, started the CBOE. And when they came, we all laughed at them. We thought they were a bunch of morons. We never thought this was going to be anything. Nobody did.
When was that?
The CBOE started in 1973 and the Amex started in 1975.
Okay, so it's just a few years.
Not a long time. It's one of the dramatic changes in the business, I think, though.
Yeah, tell me about the decision to get into options.
Well, the Amex was easy. The CBOE was hard. They started a completely new thing. I mean, there were over-the-counter options, put and call associate, but at the Amex, you have to remember in the 70s, early 70s, the equity business was dying. So we were very concerned. The CBOE started, looked like it was going to be good. It was an easy decision for us to go in it, you know. And we had a couple of people on our board who were very knowledgeable at options because they were huge options traders from New York. That helped us get started. One of the guys is a friend of mine to this day, Bill Mayer. There was another guy who's dead. He died a couple of years ago, Gus Guttag. We had two guys on the board who were very knowledgeable in the whole thing. So it wasn't much of a decision for us, you know. First of all, it wasn't an expensive thing to start. In other words, you had the same firms on the floor going to do trade the options. You didn't need a big staff. We had an options department we started, but we were lucky and we had very good people. But it wasn't a huge commitment. And the biggest expense was probably the outside legal expense to get it started. That was probably the biggest. We had to adopt all new rules to apply to options and equities. And we made some mistakes and right at the end I had to go to Washington, had a huge, to do there. Because we applied certain rules to options that were completely were in the equity market that were completely unworkable.
What were those?
Well, it's things like the traders on the floor, they couldn't buy on an uptick. You know what I mean by an uptick?
Yes.
They couldn't buy on an uptick. Well, it didn't make any sense in options because you could be trading an option on the floor and the equity could move up, and meanwhile there were no trades in the options. So the next trade is going to be an uptick, and they're out. They can't trade. I mean, I had to go down and had change the rules right like with 2 weeks to go. I remember going to Washington.
So you're going to the SEC.
Yeah. So, but it wasn't a huge commitment. Like I say, you had to do basically almost a new rule book in a way. But that was really it. There wasn't a huge thing. Like the CBOE had to build an exchange. You know, they had a whole different thing. They had to sell memberships. We had the guys there already, you know? So it was much easier for us.
Was there any difference in the way that you handled them with what the CBOE was doing? I mean, would an options trader have favored one over the other for some reason?
Well, I don't know. They're always, you know, traders are always looking for an edge, and the smart traders find it. And you, by the time you figure it out, they've moved on to another edge. But they were similar. I had some serious fights with the CBOE because I was in charge, and I mean, they had a very, very intelligent guy who was the first head of the CBOE, a guy who had been a Wall Street Journal reporter, Joe Sullivan, and he was an enormously bright guy. And they did some things, and I know they did some things that were unlawful, you know, and I never turned them in. But, you know, I talked to them about it a lot, that they were letting things, you know, they were starting something, so they let things slide some that they shouldn't have to get the business moving. Maybe I would have done the same. Who knows? No, but we were very similar. And the only thing I would say is that there are guys, I'm more than sure I know, that went from New York to Chicago because the opportunity, because they were trading a lot more than we were. The opportunities were great there, you know. There are guys who made a tremendous amount of money because they were very knowledgeable in options when the world was not really that knowledgeable yet, you know.
Right.
So if you were smart, you could make a lot of money, and some guys did make a lot of money. Still to this day, I think.
CBOE was doing a lot more volume.
They were doing more volume than us, yeah.
My impression is that the business took off pretty quickly, though.
It grew fairly rapidly, but yeah. But in those days, I don't know when this changed, but it didn't change when I was there. In other words, the options were exclusive. In other words, if CBOE had an options on General Motors, the Amex didn't.
Okay.
You see? So a lot of good stocks were locked up. That changed not that many years ago. Not that many years ago, where basically the SEC forced the whole thing to open up. And, you know, basically today we're all trading. It's like the equity market. Everybody trades the same thing, and you know,
right.
Basically, yeah. But that's the goal. And I don't know what the other huge. I think that the options is a huge development in the business. The other thing today are, and nobody knows how big this is. I don't think. And to me, the SEC has not done the job here. Is the hedge funds.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's a little bit, because I'm a regulatory background, so who knows. But to think that people tell me that the hedge funds are accounting for 30-40% of the trading on New York Stock Exchange every day, and for the government to sit there and not know what they're doing, to me is a little bit crazy. Now, my good friends in Chicago, they say, Bob, what are you talking about? What would the SEC do if they... What would they do? I said, you may be right. But to me, it's a little bit crazy that they don't even know what they're trading in. I mean, you know, there's a whole... You know, we almost had that breakdown, that meltdown with long-term capital management.
Right.
You know, who knows? I mean, yeah, the SEC, it's very hard to regulate... The market to regulate today... is so much more difficult than it was when I started in the business when they were only trading equities.
Right.
Now, you're looking at some guy and he's got X shares of equities. He's short the option. He's trading futures in the same thing. You got to have a smart investigator figure out whether he's long or short. I mean, it's a very difficult thing today, I think, to regulate. Very different. You know, one of the pluses is everything is almost automated, so you can pick it up much faster. But The market has a lot of I think it's got some scary things in it. I mean, the hedge funds are a little bit scary. I mean, you don't have to be a genius when you see, you know, 2 weeks ago in the paper, one of the hedge fund guys in New York, in 2006, he made $1.7 billion. Now, I don't have to be a genius to know that's absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah.
That there's no way he deserves it. No way.
Yeah.
You know, the hedge fund guys are running New York. All of the charities in New York. It's either their wives are on. Everyone in the Metropolitan, I don't care where it is. Used to be brokerage house guys. It's all the hedge fund guys. Because, you know, the highest paid guy in the brokerage last year was Lloyd Blankfein from Goldman Sachs. He made $57 million. That doesn't get him near. You got to make over $200 million to be listed in the hedge fund guy. I mean, they're running the place. And what do? You know, they affect everything, you see, because my son argues with me on this. My son is the political editor of the New York Post. We have a lot of arguments. What do these young guys do? The first thing they do. These are New York guys. First thing they do. They buy a $10 million apartment. You can't get a Ferrari this year in New York. They're all gone.
Hmm.
Can't get them.
What a shame.
It's a shame. then they all buy art. They don't know anything about art.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's part of the. So, I mean, and they bid up everything. That's why with the real estate market going down, Manhattan is still going up. It's all because of the Wall Street. It's all because of Wall Street. So my son said, so what? It's their money. I said, yeah, Greg, you don't understand. When people bid up things, be higher than they should be, normal guys, normal wage earners are priced out of the market. Not good for a democracy, I don't think. You know, when you just have a small group of people. Also, New York City better worry because all of their income is coming from Wall Street today. More than ever. And if there's a downturn, and there always is a downturn, let's face it. Nobody knows when, but there always is one. And
well, let's go back to when things were a little simpler.
Right.
When you got out of the special study, when you were finished.
Right.
Did you go into one of the divisions?
Yes.
At that point?
Yes. Well, we changed the name of one of our recommendations. One of our top recommendations was to change the name of trading in exchanges to trading in markets. I think that was a brilliant recommendation.
And it was something you could accomplish.
Yeah. So we could accomplish it. And I went in there. Yeah, I went in there. That was a good story. When the study was over, you know, it was 1963. How old was I? I was like 37, 38 years old already. And two things. First, the SEC was, after the special study was over, they had a special study of mutual funds. And I forget the guy's name. And the guest came to me, and I remember one, Gordon Henderson and Bob Mundheim. And they came to me, and they said, we'd like you to join. And I said, no, thank you. I said, it's about time I took a real job. You know, not going on another state. Then I got a call from Manny Cohen, who was the commissioner, you know, he was a legend at the SEC. And I knew Manny because when I worked on this over-the-counter thing, he was the commission. He wasn't the chairman then, he was a commissioner, I think. He was shepherding that, so I got to know him. And his assistant at that time, I don't know if you interviewed him, should have, Dick Phillips.
No, I haven't talked to him.
Dick Phillips. And Dick was taking a job in the general counsel's office, so. And I think Gene Rotberg was friendly with Manny, and they said, you should talk to Bob Birnbaum. And I was on vacation. Vacation meant I was home. I didn't have enough money to go anywhere. And he called me up and said, come in, wanted to interview me. So I went in there, and Manny was a funny guy. And he was sitting there. He had my personnel file in front of him. And he said, you know, I'm looking for an assistant, you know, a legal assistant. And that was considered a big job at the commission. Be a legal. In those days, they didn't have four assistants. They had one. And he said, you know, and I think I'd like to offer you the job. And so I said, Manny, I said, I really appreciate it. Ralph Saul was going into the Division of Trading as either the director or associate. He wanted me to go with him. And I said, I think I'm really too old to be anybody's assistant. Okay. And Manny said, well, I don't know if you're the right guy for the job. I said, Manny, you called me. I didn't call you. And that was, nobody ever talked to him like that. So that was the right decision for me, though, at that time. So I went to trading, and I became, I don't know if I started out as, but I wound up, I was the branch chief of the regulation of the over-the-counter market and the exchanges.
Okay. What was the big issue for you at that point? What were you spending your time thinking about?
I'm going to make more money. I don't know. I don't know. That's a long time ago. I mean, I don't know. I was fairly relaxed because I tell you what, when I went to law school and came to the SEC, I didn't know if I could be a decent lawyer. I had nothing. There was nothing in my background. I played around in college. I never did anything, I went to work for about 10 years. I was bumming around New York. I was single. I didn't pay much attention to work. I didn't like it because I was working for a women's wear chain store, which I couldn't, hated it. But I didn't do anything, I remember it was my best friend Fred Morse who said to me one day, I said, I don't know what to do. I'm working and I don't like it, And he looked me in the eye and he said, Bob, do something. That's advice I give to some kids when they give me this crap, but they don't know what they want to do.
Yeah.
Try something. The only way you're going to find out if you like anything is to do something, Not sit around saying, So that's how I ended up. Because he was a lawyer. I ended up now. I'm going to go to law school. But I don't know what the big issues in those days. We were just starting the inspections of the exchanges, We were just getting our feet wet, really,
You were looking at the over-the-counter market.
We regulated the over. We had a much more intensive look at the over-the-counter market. I knew there was a lot of trouble there because I remember one of the first things I did, all the prices were in the pink sheets in those days. And I went over, I took pink sheets from 5 years ago and checked every company, and I found out it was like, I don't remember the number, but 500 of them were bankrupt. I mean, we knew there was a whole mess there. The truth is that the SEC is responsible for the growth of the over-the-counter market because the SEC recommended that they should automate the trading. It was the SEC recommendations.
Was this during
the study? Yeah. Okay. I mean, they fought that like, crazy.
Right.
That was the best thing ever happened to them, It's the same thing with commission rates. Probably the best thing to happen to the exchanges because the volume increased dramatically, mm-hmm.
But both of these things took time, and that gets to an issue.
Right.
Which is some people say, the special study was conservative because it didn't call for enough change. It didn't have hearings, so it could build support for these changes. And it took too long for, the changes to come. 10 years sometimes, things like that.
You can always, that's easy to criticize. I don't think that's really valid, I think, because, change, there hadn't been much change in the securities markets for 40 years. We weren't looking to take down the system. In other words, we weren't looking to say there should be no specialist on the New York Stock Exchange. That would have been a fight you wouldn't win.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fight you couldn't win. And I remember about the automation. They sent me once, right early in the game. I went to the Defense Department to interview a husband and wife team. I think their name was James. And they had they had created a computer program for the securities markets, all automated. And I came back and Ralph Sewell asked me, I said, yeah, they did it. Maybe it works. Maybe it doesn't. I mean, who knows? You know, who knows what it does to the liquidity in the market, in other words. You know, I had no idea. You know, this, at least with the specialists, you knew, of course, they were making a lot of money that they probably shouldn't have made. But the liquidity is one of the most important things in the market. Mm-hmm. And you can make a market maybe so efficient that no guys say to themselves, hey, look, if I put my money in T-bills without any risk, I'm better off than doing this because, the, you know, the profit margin, it's, I mean, it's, you see changes already. I mean, when I was at the New York Stock Exchange, there were probably 25 to 30 specialist units. They probably got 5 to 8 today. Now, the same number of guys, but they're all in huge operations. They've all been bought out. And it's the same in all the floors. In the CBOE, it's the same thing. Now, you know, that means there's more risk because you have smaller groups of people. So, you know, dramatic change. Look, SEC, the special study really was the cause of getting rid. I don't know if you know about, they had odd lot brokers.
Right.
I mean, that was the biggest, you know, all the guys who had gone to, rich guys who had gone to Princeton became odd lot brokers because you could be a moron. You didn't have, you didn't have to do anything.
Right.
You didn't have to do anything. We got, you know, really, we were the ones who started that out.
Did that go out in the 64?
I don't think it went out right away, but we killed them, I mean, certainly. You know, so there was a lot of things the study did. We weren't looking to change the world. We didn't know enough about the world to change the world, you know.
Yeah.
We were just feeling our own way, you know, getting educated. So it's hard to get educated and say, well, everything has to change. But, you know, look, if you were starting out, you wouldn't have had all these regional exchanges. The regional exchanges occurred because of the fact that in the 20s and 30s, there was not good communications in the United States. So out west, you had the mining companies on the exchange. In Philadelphia, you had the railroads. It was germane to their area. You know, clearly, do you need them? Even today, do you need them? If there was one place they could do it all. However, you know, the fact that there wasn't, New York got driven into some things they didn't want to get driven into because the regional exchanges were always looking for some way to get business and they came up with things. I think Chicago came up with one of the first clearing systems. I mean, you know, so competition is always good. I don't think it's good to have one person. New York, certainly in those days, if they could have, would wipe anybody out if they could have. I mean, they didn't want any competition, period, you know. So, I mean, you can criticize it. I mean, there's always things that could have been better, but I think, for what it was, I think it was very unusual, really.
So there wasn't a group that was unhappy
We didn't have fights because guys said, no, God damn it, you guys, you're not going far enough, you know.
Okay.
We didn't have any of that.
Okay.
If it happened, I was not present.
Okay.
And first of all, it was very segmented, you know. In other words, everybody on the study didn't get involved in the specialist system. The two
right.
main guys in it was Dave Silva and my good friend Gary Strum. They were, who's working for Dave. They both became very expert. The over-the-counter market, there was, I think Rotberg was very heavy in the over, and there was a guy who's very sick today, I understand, Dick Meyer. They, you know, so guys became very conversant in their area, but every other guy was not really familiar, you know, with what was going on in all the areas. So we didn't have those kind of arguments.
Okay.
Whether the guys at the top did, you know, I mean, you know, top guys tend to be more conservative than the guys at the bottom. And that's just a fact of life. I mean, even when I went to the New York Stock Exchange, I said to the chairman, hey, look, you know, when they hired me, there was all kinds of speculation that, you know, that Birnbaum was going to merge New York and Amex, which they've been trying for 40 years and they could never get it done. And I said, look, I didn't come here to change the goddamn world. I said, you know. And I said, I didn't come here to get rid of the specialist system because that's going to take a couple of years. And I don't feel like fighting for 3 years about something like that when I don't even know the end result is better. I told him right at the beginning, you know, New York was lucky in a way because they brought in a lot of automation because they had a chairman, John Phelan, who was the first guy who was a specialist who became the top guy. And he was a very smart guy, John. Very, very smart. And very politically astute. And he's smarter than all the guys on the floor, so he could convince them. And every breakfast, lunch, and dinner was with a purpose. So I would have lunch with my friends. He would have lunch. Everything was with a purpose. He was would have been a great ward politician. But he convinced the specialists about automating because they didn't want to automate anything. And if New York hadn't started that, they would never have been able to handle the business and the government would have clamped down. Something would have happened. If the government would have done something, they would have been so upset that they could never let it exist the way it existed. Yeah. So they're lucky they moved that way.
Well, speaking of not being able to handle the business, when you came into Amex, one of the first things to hit after that was the back office problem.
We had to close down, as I remember. First it was a half hour every day, then it was every Wednesday. I mean, yeah.
What could Amex do about that other than closing down every day?
Well, they could have had a better system, but it takes time to develop that. And they had to study what was there and figure out what to do. I think we hired somebody. I don't know if it was the Rand Corporation or something. The Amex was very heavily involved with Ralph Saul and maybe more than New York in straightening everything out in the back office.
To
figure out how we can automate this and do it better, yeah.
Okay.
Ralph was very instrumental in that, I think. Yeah. I never got involved in that.
Okay. Was the SEC involved?
Well, sure they were involved, but I don't think they knew what to do, really. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think they knew what to do. If they knew, they would have told us. I don't think they knew what to do.
So you handled a series of special projects for Ralph Saul, I guess.
Yeah, that's when the beginning. Yeah.
What were some of the things you were doing?
Oh, geez. You think I remember these things, God Almighty? I don't really remember. Okay. I don't remember. Jeez, you're talking about 40 years ago. My God.
Yeah.
God Almighty.
Well, another big issue that comes up, and we're talking about automation. And that is the way that NASDAQ took off. And the SEC starts talking about a national market system and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I was involved in that. So.
Did Amex, from your perspective in Amex, did you see this as a problem or as an opportunity?
Well, the Amex was really a lot like New York in the sense that while we were much smaller and we didn't have the quality companies that they had, we were like New York in essence, and maybe even more so. I don't know the numbers anymore, but we were really like a monopoly in our stocks, you know, because the third market, the overcount, was more focused on the quality stocks on New York than they were on Amex stocks. And the regional exchanges, while they did Amex, we were like New York. We weren't looking for great change because we were doing most of the business. We didn't see a great opportunity for us. What were we going to capture? You know what I mean? Just like New York, you know, with the present the guy that they have, he realizes that they're not going to capture more of what business in the stocks that they trade, they've got to look for other opportunities, which has been very difficult for New York. I mean, like when I was there, the New York traded futures. I actually sold the futures exchange that the futures market that the Amex had. I sold that to New York. And New York, you know, in options, when they started trading options, they thought New York that they would be able to capture a lot of business, because, you know, because the thing is, what happens is the top guys at New York call up the CEO of Merrill Lynch and they say, you know, we're going to start options, you know, we hope you're going to give us, oh, absolutely, we're going to give the business to you, okay? And they call all around. Everybody says, yeah, terrific idea, because firms like more competition. They don't like anybody. They're afraid somebody has all of it. Just like most of the major firms today, I know for a fact, are opposing the Chicago Board of Trade, Chicago Mercantile getting together, because they think they're going to have too much of the business. They're telling the government, don't let them do this. They're afraid then they change the pricing or whatever, you know. So they like it a little bit divided. But New York, then what happens is you start trading, and the CEO, who knows nothing about options to begin with, unless he came out of that, and most of the CEOs didn't, but the guys who decide where the business is going are sitting at the trading desk in Merrill Lynch. They've got relationships with these Amex, with the CBOE, and they say, well, what the hell do I want to go to New York for? They say, what the hell, forget the CEO, who cares about him? So nobody gave him business. I mean, they had their
establishment. They weren't worried about getting a lower price.
No, well, you know, the chances are that you get the best price where the most volume is. Mm-hmm. And the guy starting out is not going to give you the best price generally. Where the most volume, you know, it always turned out that the guys who got the volume immediately, they were the ones who started attracting more, because they go where the volume goes. You know, that's what always seemed to happen. So New York has never really been able to transfer their name to another product. You know, and the funny thing is, the further away you get from New York, Europe, Asia, the further away you get, the better the New York's name is. But for the people who control most of the business in New York, they know it's a bunch of nonsense. I mean, you know, but yeah, like when I was president of New York, if I used to go to make a speech far away, oh, they thought, gee, this guy is president of New York, what a big deal. New York, you go to a party, there's 50 guys there that could buy and sell you. I mean, the guy who's running Bear Stearns, the guy from one of the advertising, I mean, you know, further away you got, the better they looked at you. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it is. But, New York, I don't think, has an easy road to hoe here. In some ways, I think they're probably lucky that they got this guy, John Thayne, who's a very bright guy, and is not beholden to anything from New York. You know, because you can be sure that when you're working for Goldman Sachs or Salomon Smith Barney, Morgan, they laugh at New York. First of all, they don't, you know, you take a firm like Merrill Lynch. Mm-hmm. When I started in the business, I'm sure that they got 75% of their revenue from trading equities. I mean, investors trading, yeah. Commission. Yeah. I should say commission. Today, must be minuscule. If it's more than 10%, I'd be surprised. Where are they getting their money? Investment banking. I think the Goldman Sachs had a statement, last 3 months, they made 75% of their money in proprietary trading. So what do they care about the exchange? It means nothing to them. They're not, you know, they're doing so many other things. They're all of them. I mean, which is a little bit scary too, in that the proprietary trading of the firms has increased so dramatically.
And that's trading without an exchange.
Well, some of it is on an exchange, but some of it they go all over the world. They're trading, and they're trading different products. They're trading interest rates futures. They're trading, you know, God knows what they're doing. You know, I mean, it's a little bit risky, but, you know, insiders, you can't take away an edge of an insider. It's like a public person who's, you know, I tell any individual who's trading a lot, you got to be a moron to do that. It's one thing, you know, I always tell my kids, they don't listen. I always say, you buy a quality stock and put it in the vault. You can't trade in and out and expect to beat professionals. The hedge fund guys who are sitting there, you got to be crazy. First of all, where is all the inside information going? That's another place I think the SEC has been lax. No doubt in my mind that hedge funds have been getting inside information for a good number of years. If you have inside information and you're at a brokerage house, you're going to call Ken Durr, who trades 200 shares of a stock, or you're going to call a hedge fund that's giving you God knows how much money in commissions. You're getting all this information, I'm sure. You know, the SEC should have been looking into that God knows how long ago.
Well, you know, you're talking about the end result, at least where we are now in this ongoing process. I want to get some sense of how you saw things changing back in the 70s, when you're in the Amex, and then later on when you moved over to New York.
Well, what, you know, the biggest change to me was that, you know, when you started in the 60s, people weren't interested in the markets. I mean, you know, and when you got into the late 70s and 80s, I mean, you get in a taxi cab, if a guy found out you worked in exchange, the taxi driver wanted to have a long conversation. Before that, nobody was really interested. It was a very small number of people. You know, and one of the things, of course, that happened is that even people of moderate means or less than moderate means, either because of their pension or investing in mutual funds, had a strong interest in the stock market. It wasn't always like that. People, you know, I'm sure my father never thought about the stock market. Never had any money in it. He didn't have a pension, you know. And that changed, I think, as people of very moderate and less than moderate means had money that was being invested, even if they didn't know it. They did know it, but they didn't know where it was going most of the time.
Well, you're talking about the rise of institutional investors.
The institutional investors changed everything, yeah, absolutely.
How did it change Amex while you were there?
Well, while we were there, of course, we had an institutional business, but we still had more of the smaller investors than I'm sure New York did, because of the stocks that we had, probably had less interest to professional investors than New York stocks, you know. We didn't see great changes. We saw that there were many more people interested in the market, you know, and try to take advantage of that. And of course, we spent a lot of time developing the option business, because the option is a dichotomy in that the option business, when we started, to the exchange as an institution, was not terribly meaningful in a financial sense. We didn't have listed companies paying us fees to list and ongoing fees, which was a huge part of our income. But it was very, very important to the trading floor. The specialist firms, they were, I think, you know, even going back into the 80s, a lot of them were making more money trading options than trading equities. And that was very important to us because, you know, what is the exchange? If these guys aren't there, what are we? We're nothing. Mm-hmm. Just a building. Not even a great building, but whatever. So I'm saying, you didn't make the same money. Now it seems like I see from my CBOE board thing, I see that we're making money now. I don't know how it all comes in, but we're making money. Like in the first quarter of this year, we made net profit of about $35 million, which is a lot for the, I mean, for the exchange to end up making over $100 million, you know, is a terrible amount of money. When I was at the Amex, I mean, if we had a working capital of $20 million, we probably had a lot of money, you know? Of course, one of the things that's happened, that's another thing I think the SEC has failed to address, maybe they're right, the going public of these institutions. Now, I'm sure that when, not saying we would have been right, but when I was at the SEC, if this would have happened, there's no doubt in my mind, we would have called public hearings.
You mean the stock exchange? Yeah.
We would never have allowed them to go public without figuring out what does this mean to the world, to the investors. We would have done something. We certainly would have held public hearings. And we would have had experts testify. Maybe we would have come up with nothing, and maybe everything is fine. But there is a dramatic change. I mean, I see it already at the CBOE. We in Chicago, the Chicago Board of Trade is public, the Chicago Mercantile is public. We are not. And we are in the process, and, we've hired Goldman Sachs, and we're in the process, but we have some complications that other people didn't have, which may delay us, maybe not. Depends on how we handle it. It's a very peculiar thing at the CBOE. Anybody who is a member of the Chicago Board of Trade has the right to trade on the CBOE, and that's all kinds of complications when you're going public. And what are they entitled to? You know, so there's a lot of talks going on. But you see that the stocks of these institutions in the last 5 years have been the best investment in the whole market. I was on the board of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange for 8 years, I think, from 1990 to 1998, or I don't know. And they went public. I shouldn't have left their board. I made a mistake. Of course, the guy who was the CEO left and went to the CBOE, and he said to me, "Bob, resign and come with me," which I did. So I was public. I think I would have got stock. His stock was issued at $35 a share, trading at about $500. You know, because I have a little concern that when you focus on the bottom line and there are 3 months reports or financials, that can have an impact on what staff does, you know. And they're all... Even now, we haven't even gone public. I see it in the staff. We've already fired 10% of the people. So we want to get our financial... The reason people say, why are they so good investments? I say, because idiots like me ran them. And they weren't run like a corporation. In other words, we didn't worry about every dollar.
Right.
Now, they're getting ready to go public. They're all focused on getting our financials so we'll get a good price. Changes things. Now maybe that'll be for the better. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure, you know. And it'll force changes in regulation, and they'll want to take regulation away from the exchange and put it in a separate entity, as New York and is already doing in a way with NASDAQ. Whether that's good or bad, I don't think anybody knows. And the SEC hasn't done anything to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, the idea is that the market will come up with a brilliant solution.
Yeah, the market will do. Maybe that's right, you know. Maybe that's right.
Well, that's drastically different from what was going on in the 70s when, you know, the 75 Amendment actually, I think, you know, said to the SEC, well, take a look and see what you can come up with as far as changing the market, coming up with a centralized market.
Yeah, but that, you know, basically that all came out of the special study in a way.
Yeah.
And now all those guys are gone and the whole thinking is gone.
Yeah.
It's a different world.
But my question to you is, I know that the SEC basically, you know, rather than sit around and think, they went out and talked to people. And I'm wondering if Amex was consulted, New York Stock Exchange was consulted. Do you remember any movement
there? As far as the national markets,
yeah.
Well, there were hearings.
Okay.
There were hearings in those days. Yeah, there were hearings. I'm sure, And there were, if there weren't hearings, and I think there might have been, there were position papers that went out. You know, the SEC would send out a 100-page position paper, and we would respond to it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they were consulted in a sense, yes.
How serious did you think this was?
Oh, it was serious. Yeah, it was serious. Yeah.
I mean, if it was really serious, you would have started wondering what you were going to do next, because this could have, you know, this could have done something to change your business.
We never thought we were going to go out of business. We never had that kind of a thought. Maybe some of the regionals did, but we didn't think, we never thought that, no. Mm-hmm. No.
Okay. Well, I noticed that apparently the Amex and the New York Stock Exchange came close to merging in 77.
Well,
that's what the talk was.
Yeah, well, I probably know as much about that as anyone. There was discussions that were at a higher level that I don't even think reached, you know, I became president of the Amex in 77, I think. 77, yeah. 77. And I'm sure there were talks, because we were always pressured every year, the Securities Industry Association, which was the, you know, the lobbying, they always wanted one exchange in New York rather than two. In fact, before I came to the Amex, when I was at the SEC, the Institutional Investor magazine was just starting. Gil Kaplan was the guy who started. He was a former Amex employee, a very bright guy. And Gil came to me in Washington and said, I'd like you to write an article for our first issue. And I said, okay. And I called him up a day later. I said, I'm going to write, here's my article. It's New York : why two exchanges? And then I accepted a job about a month later with the Amex. I said, I'm not going to write the article. But, you know, so that always was the thing. Now, you know, whether there was anything really in it to save money, I guess, if, you know, New York's building is a crappy building to begin with. In other words, they, you know, like, it doesn't even have one trading floor. You got to go three different rooms. I mean, you know, it's not a great building by any stretch of the imagination. And if you can't put the two together in one building, your savings are going to be minuscule. Now, yes, you can save on staff. That's, you know, you don't need two presidents. You can save on staff. But the big savings is getting rid of, for the firms, is getting rid of the all of the guys that they have to have on the floor of the Amex and all of that stuff. And if you can't put them together, I don't think it's a great savings, and you know, whatever.
So the vision was simply a bigger exchange.
Now, I was hired after I left New York, and I was working for a law firm in New York. Left New York in 1988, and I went to the law firm. I was there 88 to 93. The Amex hired me to go over to New York. Bill Donaldson had become chairman. He knew nothing. He'd been out of the business for a long time. Business had changed dramatically from when he was in the business. But he became SEC chairman and did a good job. They asked me to go over and talk to Donaldson and see if I could put a merger together with the two of them. So I went over to talk to him a couple of times, and he was there, and Dick Russell was always present. Dick was smart enough never to say a word. And you know, New York always looked down their noses at the Amex, and the guys on the floor, that's not our quality guys on the floor over there compared to us, you know. And they're probably right. What's in it for New York? And if you're a member on the floor, what the heck is in it for you? You know, I mean, so there wasn't much push for it. It's what's been mentioned for 30, 40 years, you know, because it sounds like the right thing to do. But whether it's really meaningful, who knows? I mean, I don't know.
A couple of little things. Were you
I understand that it was you or some of your people at Amex that told the SEC about Foster Winans and heard on the street.
Me.
Tell me about
it. Was
that.
Me. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. That particular.
That I remember very well, because first of all, Foster Winans had the nerve about 4 weeks ago. He wrote on the editorial page of Times an editorial saying there shouldn't be any laws against insider trading. He mentioned that he had gone to jail for it. You know. Well, what happened was, I don't know what year that was. I forget. I was president, yeah, I guess. And the worst thing was my son was working for the journal at the time. And our trading department, the surveillance, they came up with about, I don't know how many situations, a good number of situations where a stock moved dramatically before wine. The Heard on the Street column was the most influential column you could have, moved dramatically before his, before there was something in Foster Winans thing. So they can't, you know, the staff came to me and they didn't know what to do. What are they going to do? They can't subpoena Foster Winans. They don't have any authority. He doesn't have to talk to them, period. So I went down to the SEC. And I gave the material to the SEC. And the SEC called Winans. The journal, I forget who was the top guy. I don't know if it was Peter Kahn, then it was the second. I forget who it was. I didn't like them, and they didn't like me anyway. And called me up. He calls me up. He says, Bob, why did you give that to the SEC? Why didn't you come to me? I said, how do I know you weren't involved in it? I said, if you don't think I did the right thing, why don't you call the SEC and ask them what they think about what Birnbaum did? Of course, the SEC said Birnbaum did exactly the right thing. So this, we got out in the newspapers. There was a fight between us. My poor son was working there. Oh, my God. I don't know if they knew I was his father, though, but whatever. But in the journal was always very pompous. You know, they really were. They were very, I never could stand their management. They had the best reporter in the country on the markets, the guy Dick Rustin, who lived in my town. And Dick was the best. The Times was scooped every, the Times, people have written articles about this. The Times comes from a background out of the South. They were southern merchants, the Sulzbergers. And they didn't like the markets. They never did a good job. The only time they ever were really a good job, as good as the Journal, was always ahead of them, was when I was at the SEC, they had a reporter, the Journal, Eileen Shanahan. She was fantastic. And I think because she was a woman, she didn't go as far. She, you know, she went to another paper, and then she'd be... Then she actually, the funny thing, she actually became like a professor for Northwestern journalism in Washington. They used to send the 3 months out of the year, they would send the kids to Washington, and they would represent a paper from around the United States that didn't have anybody in Washington. And so my son was in the program. And my son was sitting there one day, and my son was the kind of kid, he's such a... He never would even tell anybody that his father was president of New York. I mean, you don't talk about those things. He was in the office there where their class was, and across the board tape it came out, New York Stock Exchange, name is Birnbaum, president of the exchange. And this girl was, the girl who my son hated was sitting at the broad tape. She said, oh, Greg, your father just became president of the exchange. She's just ribbing him. Eileen Shanahan is there. She said, that is his father. My son was so, he said once he liked it that I was president. But the journal was very tough. I remember going to the journal to appear before their board when we started to trade options. And I went there with a guy from Goldman Sachs, Bob Mnuchin, who was one of the first big block traders in the country, Bob. And he was on our board, and we went over, we made a presentation to them to allow us, we wanted them to allow us to trade options on the Dow Jones Index. And that would have been huge. You know, that would have really been really huge. They looked like this, they were, you know, we're a newspaper, we're not interested in that, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, well, today it's different, they're in it. But they really looked down, maybe if I was them I would too, but they really were very pompous, I always thought, dealing with them. I mean, I even went out with their famous, I went to lunch, I remember, with their guy, Bob Bartley, who was their head of the editorial page for like 25 years. He was like a legend. Didn't know what he was talking about. He had written something about the exchange. It was totally wrong. So I went to have lunch with him. He didn't hear a word I said. Couldn't care less. I mean, he couldn't, you know, I mean, I never liked them. I mean, I just never did.
Well, that was a tough time for them. And it was sort of the leading edge of the all the insider trading.
Of course, you know where Winans was giving his information? To his gay boyfriend, too.
Right. Yeah, it's quite a story.
I mean, he was a slimy guy, though. And for him to write this thing about a month ago, you know, because there's people have made arguments for years that there shouldn't be anything against insider trading because the information gets out faster and the market reaches its equilibrium faster, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, but people are, you know, like Winans, he has no, I mean, he's giving information to a guy who's sure to make money and somebody else, if they knew about it, wouldn't be selling to him.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, he doesn't make much sense, you know. But
well, when all the insider trading stuff hit, what you would have been, I guess you were in New York at that point.
Well, yeah, but you have to remember, a lot of the insider trading cases come out of the exchanges. And I'm sure to this day. In other words, we found a lot of it.
Yeah.
And we give it to the SEC because we can't pursue it. We found out.
Well, you're a self-regulating organization, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And we had, you know, they had, when I was at, you know, when I was at Amex, I didn't pay, even though it all reported to me. You know, I didn't spend a lot of my time worrying about how they were figuring out what the specialists did. And, you know, I was much more, I don't think I was a good chief operating officer. I was much more onto bigger, I was used to dealing with, a pompous, well, global issues, rather than whether some guy is stealing. I mean, I was never interested in putting guys, getting guys fired or putting in jail for a little, you know. Mm-hmm. I was too soft for that. I always thought the guy's got a wife and a kid, he might be a good husband and father. I never, you know, I was more interested in the global thing. How is the market going to look? What's the structure going to be? But in New York, New York had a lot of very good, programs, regulatory programs, you know, because the programs got more sophisticated over time. And it could spit out in a second relationships, who was on other boards, whether, you know, you got a lot of good information. Some of its users, like Ivan Boesky, every day at New York when I was there, the machine spit his name out. Every day. Well, what could you do? He was trading, you know, bigger than anybody in the country. So every day he got spit out because of the volume or what. But until Marty Siegel turned him in, I don't know how you would have gone. You know? Very hard, I mean, to get everything, you know. I always liked it at the SEC because when you were at the SEC, you could pick and choose what you were going to focus on. Whereas when you're at the exchange or the NASD, and I was on the NASD board, you got to cover everything. I mean, you know, it's impossible. I mean, the NASD, I mean, thousands of firms are under their jurisdiction. I mean, it's a very difficult job, you know, to find, you know, to catch everybody, you know. There's always...
Another difficult job. October 87.
I love that.
You love that?
I did. I loved October 87.
Tell me why.
A lot of days you go to work in New York, my wife could do the job better. nothing happens, the machines are running, whatever, blah, blah, blah. You know, not a big deal. It's only when there's something, you know, happens, it's like the president, he probably makes three important decisions a year and he's wrong on all of them, but that's all you're really doing. The rest of the stuff, he's going shaking hands with somebody, you know. So I felt, I know what I'm doing and I'm going to make my decisions. And so the thing is, you know, so we did a lot of things, and the thing is, people are, and I said this in speeches so I can say it, and the New York allowed me to say it, so I, you know, it didn't stop me. That, you know, people think because you're sitting at the New York Stock Exchange, you know what the whole, how, what's going on all over the world. In the middle of that first and second day, Merrill Lynch could have been in net capital violation. We wouldn't have known it, and they wouldn't have known it either. We could have had 10 specialists on the floor who were belly up, and we wouldn't have known. You know, you can't get the information that fast. You know, I think we did some smart things. I mean, Alan Greenspan was not available. He had just become chairman of the Fed. And we knew him because we had hired him when I was at New York. He never did the work that he was supposed to do because he came and said, I just took the job of the Fed and I'm not going to do the work. He's a nice character. And he was, I'll tell you a story about him, that day. He had left Washington, so he couldn't get him. And luckily, there was a guy at the Fed, Jerry Carrier. I think he's now a partner of Goldman. And we talked to him. We said, you know, and they knew from the experience of 1929 that one of the things happened in 29 is that the banks cut off credit, and the markets just didn't function.
Right.
So Corrigan talked to all of the banks and told them, keep the money flowing, because, you know, they could have cut off the specialist, and the specialist wouldn't have been able to trade. So we covered that part of it. We sort of divided things. I was talking to all of the... Phelan was talking to, like, the Fed, and to the White House, and I was talking to all of the exchanges and things like that to, you know, keep them apprised as much as I could of what's going on. But nobody really knew. And we did things. We did some smart things. We stopped the firms from using their automated systems to trade proprietary on exchanges. They were doing program trading in those days. A lot of program trading was taking, you know, 40 million at a shot just pressing a button. We stopped that.
I mean, did that get you right off? This must be program trading.
No, I didn't think it was program trading, but we just thought we should stop what we can stop, you know. I don't think we know to this day what caused it. You know, in the studies that were done, you know, you found things out like between 11 and 12 o'clock, four institutions sold, and in those days we used to trade maybe $6 billion a day, maybe, you know, in value. And in an hour, we had four institutions sold $5 billion worth of stock. You know, now, you know, I always worried, I made a speech about it, that what happens if all the institutions decided to sell? What the hell would have happened? Well, what would have happened is the market would have essentially closed. And see, the thing is, we didn't close the market because it turned Tuesday at around midday. Now, if it would have gone all day, I think the market would have been closed. But the funny thing is, the market was already closed. People, you know, we used to get, it's so funny, sophisticated people. Like, I went to a meeting of the New York, we had a committee, top lawyers in the United States were on the committee. Bob Fleischer was one of the guys, he was on the committee. And it was a meeting at night. And it was like Thursday of that week. I walked into the meeting. They applauded. Ridiculous. Didn't do anything. I mean, they applauded. They really thought you kept the exchange open. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of the major stocks, trading had already been stopped. In other words, they were the floor officials. We stopped trading in general. There was no trading going on. You didn't have to close the exchange. Your top 100 stocks were already not trading. You know, close the exchange, the thinking was, psychologically, it's a very bad thing to do. We panic people all over the country. So if we can keep the, ostensibly keep it open, it's probably a good thing, you know. But the best thing that happened was I was going home Monday night, about 11 o'clock at night. Then I had, my driver, and my driver was a tough kid. Treated me like I was a moron. I mean, he was not respectful in any way. He never got out in his life to open the door, Never.
I'm sure you liked that, though.
I liked it, yeah. So we were going home, and the phone rang. And he picked up the phone, and the guy said, "This is Howard Baker, the chief of staff of the president. I'd like to speak to Mr. Birnbaum." So he hands me the phone, and Howard says, "How's everything, Bob? As if I know." I said, "The machines are running. As far as we know, the machines, we're clearing the trays, where everything is operating. And what's going to happen tomorrow, I can't tell you." So we get home. Next day, he comes to pick me up. The driver, he's standing outside with the door open. Okay, I said, I use this in my speeches too. I said, he said, Birnbaum can't be as dumb as I thought he was if the president's chief of staff is calling him. And Greenspan that day was flying from Washington to Houston to speak at the American Bankers Association. So he leaves Washington. The market is down was huge already, 150 points maybe. He gets down there and he gets out at the airport and gets into a taxi. Market's closed, and he says to the driver, "What did the market do today?" And the driver says, "It's down 508. And Greenspan says, "Oh, that's phenomenal, down 5 points. The guy says, 508. He almost had a heart attack. He raced. He'd been out of it. I mean, we couldn't, Luckily, Corrigan's a very smart guy, but it was funny. But, the crash... I felt in a way, I said, "Jesus, I get paid a lot of money, more than you should get paid, in a job that is not, with my background, I didn't think is that enormously difficult, I said, "In these 2 days, I earned my money for the year." I said, I really earned it. I mean, I did something. Where I earned my money, and I like that.
Well, maybe that's why you got the applause.
Maybe.
Is there anything that we haven't covered?
No.
I
haven't thought about it a lot. More interest in my tennis game, I tell you. But no, I just think it was the SEC was a terrific place, had very good people. Which I think, I don't know, I'm not intimately involved with them, but I meet with them every year because I'm on the CBOE and I'm on their, I used to be head of their regulatory oversight committee, and I'm still on it, but until this year I was chairman. And so I go meet with the SEC top staff every year. And I can see that they're bright. They're bright people. It's so funny, bright. You don't know what's going to happen. Harvey Pitt was probably the most knowledgeable chairman in the history of the SEC. He comes out as a complete failure. Okay? Bill Donaldson and Arthur Levitt become chairman. They don't really know anything about the major issues. They come out smelling like a rose. I mean...
You worked closely with Arthur Levitt, I would guess.
Sure.
Did you think he had it in to be an SEC chair?
Well, to be perfectly frank, not in a million years. Except I shouldn't, I dismiss him too quickly. I had just gotten married, and I still to this day don't know how he found me. I was at Fire Island at a friend's house. He calls me up, Arthur. And we didn't stay in much contact. He calls me up and he says, "I've been offered the chairmanship of the SEC, and I'd like you to come with me. I'd like to make you general counsel, and you can run the place from there. I said, number one, I'm not even a good lawyer. You can get young, bright guys to be general counsel. Secondly, you know, I don't want to move to Washington. So. But he came out as far as, you know, Arthur was extremely, he's a very good speaker. Very good speaker. And he looks the part. You know. And he handled the press very well. And if you didn't see him a lot, the company guys loved him. You know. Because he was, the company guy called me, he'd fly there immediately. I mean, you know. He didn't spend a lot of time in the office.
Well, that's important.
But he, you got to say, to this day, Smell came out, you know, he's an advisor at the Carlisle. He's, you know, made a lot of money for himself. You got to give him credit. I mean, he knew what to focus on. Even though I don't think he ever wrote a word, or, I mean, the speeches, he hired somebody. I never got a memo, one sentence memo from him when I was there. And you know, people say, well, Bob, when New York hired me, they said, Bob, we know you run the place. They knew Arthur. I said, well, don't dismiss him like that. I'm the chief operating officer. I'm supposed to run the place. So don't dismiss him. You know, what he did, he didn't pay much attention to what was going on. And when he came there, when he became chairman, I had just become president, and I decided I wasn't telling him anything. You know, I didn't even talk to him. I mean, I didn't need him for, I was making my own decisions and running the place. And one day I kept track of everything I did. And I wrote it all down. And there were a lot of big things. There was one thing, I stopped an offering, Bear Stearns, when issued offering, because they found asbestos in the Matchbox cars. And I told them, you have to refund everybody's money. Big deal. I mean, there was a lot of money involved. And I wrote everything down. At the end of the day, I went into Arthur's office. I closed the door. I said, Arthur, I want to tell you something. I told him why. So he said, why are you telling me? I said, Arthur, you're the chairman. I was wrong to do this without speaking to you. He said, Bob, you can just keep doing what you're doing. Now, of course, if anything would have went wrong, he would have hung me out to dry.
Yeah.
But he got away with us. He would go away on vacation for 3 weeks, not call in once.
Yeah.
Come back, not even come in and say, how was everything?
Well, again, it's the big picture person.
He did what he liked to do. He was very effective with what he did, you know? Very effective. He probably got a lot of listings for the exchange because company guys liked him, you know? Mm-hmm. And he was a great, you know, when he was with the brokerage house, he was in charge of the salesman. They used to send him around the country to him, you know, talking to him. Sandy Wild wasn't discussing strategy with him. I think they hated one another. To this day, I think. They hate one another. You know, they're all competition anyway. Who's got more money? And of course, Sandy's got the most anyway.
Yeah.
But, well,
Richard Grasso didn't do too badly either.
I don't know. I was very friendly with him. Grasso worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
He was a terrific worker. Right, worked hard, and I didn't like New York Stock Exchange staff. I didn't think much of them at all. I respected Phelan, and I thought Grasso was terrific, and they had a good general counsel, Hank Poole, I thought was the rest of the people. I didn't think much of. I thought the Amex we had much better people. The guys who worked for me, they all became presidents of companies. Terrific. My theory was you'll never hire a guy unless he's smarter than you.
Right.
And some guys, including Grasso, they don't like that. They want to be the top dog. Dick, what happened, you know, we used to go, I used to take, even when I left, he'd take my wife and I to dinner every 2 months with his wife. When this happened, my wife said, Bob, call Dick. I said, why? He said he's liable to kill himself. The exchange was his wife. He never went home. He had 4 kids, small then. And he went out every night with a company guy, member on the floor. He was out every night.
Yeah.
I mean, he knew what he was doing. And he was a very effective speaker. You could send him to speak to IBM's board, and he would... And then you could send him to speak to a bunch of roughnecks from somewhere, from the floor. Perfect. Do a perfect job for you.
One said he didn't work hard.
Yeah, well, you know, what happened? I mean, it's hard to say. It's ludicrous that he made that kind of money.
Right.
Because, you know, they say, well, our theory, we decided that he should get paid like the head of Merrill Lynch or Goldman. That's nonsense. Because when you're president of the exchange, you don't have any money up. There's no risk to you whatsoever.
Right.
Whereas if you're the head of, you know, Lloyd Blankfein, if Goldman goes under, all his money is gone. I mean, it's not going to happen, 999 out of 1,000, but he's dealing, and it's a much different kind of place to run. Do you realize what it is to run an outfit like Goldman Sachs? Oh, my God. He's a very smart guy. I had lunch with him
about
6 months ago. Very, very bright guy. Very, very bright. Running the exchange is different. I mean, it doesn't have that kind of dynamic to it. I mean, yeah, there are some decisions that are critical, but Goldman, there must be one a week there where they got money invested, whether they should invest, whether they should go to China or whether they should go to Russia. Blankfein's assistant, they sent to Russia. He's doing work for us, and we had a conference call last week, and I said, where are you? He says, I'm in Moscow. They have a theory now in Goldman that you got to work 2 years in a foreign country if you're going to go up the ladder there. No, but I don't, you know, to say he should get paid. And the other thing is, I know, and, you know, if you've been in corporate life, you know, that the CEO doesn't get paid. He arranges it. In other words, he stacks the compensation committee.
Right.
The guy who was the head of the compensation committee was one of Grasso's friends, the guy who used to be the head of Home Depot. He's a friend of Grasso's. He's worth $1 billion. He figures he's going to get Grasso money. Now, I don't... If they offered me that, would I have turned it down? No. But I never would have arranged it.
Yeah.
In other words, I never would have been talking to guys. And I don't think he's ever going to give any money back. And Spitzer is gone. And, you know, I don't think they'll do anything about it. But... one of the questions is, I know the guy who presented it to the board, and Spitzer has testimony from him saying that he didn't tell the board before he told the board, he showed Grasso what he's going to present. So it was arranged in a way, you know. I was out with somebody, my wife and I, 2 weeks ago, was a friend of Dick's, and he told me that Dick isn't doing anything. I called him up the day it happened. I wrote a letter to him, never responded to my call or the letter. My son says, you must have said something in, you know, because I was get that when it happened, all the TV stations called me. CNN wanted to send a limo to bring me in. I turned everybody down.
Yeah.
What was I going to say? But I did say something to the Times, and I'm sure Dick, you know, probably like an elephant. He's like Mayor Kachukuri. They never forget a slight. I forget who insulted me.
Yeah.
You know, who wants to remember that all my life? But I said something like, they asked me, well, what is the New York job going to be like in the future? They didn't ask me about Dick. And I said, it's going to be, and I think I was right. I said, it's going to be technological, regulatory. It will not be marketing. And my son said, Dick took that as you saying all he was marketing.
Hmm.
Which he was. Yes, he was. Terrific at it.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I appreciate your talking to me.
Okay.